This is Robin Gale, coordinator of DARU, the Disability Advocacy Resource Unit. This is session two of the Advocacy Sector Conversations Forum held on Tuesday, the 22nd of October 2013 at the Queen Victoria Women's Centre. This is session two, Building Partnerships. Joining us now is Wendy Sanderson, who is the Senior Advisor Strategic Projects at the Victorian Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission. And Wendy joins us today to speak within this session we're calling Building Partnerships. And she's going to speak to us quite a bit about the work of the Commission and in particular some of the key projects that they're working on. Wendy is happy to take questions throughout her presentation. So if I can just encourage you and remind you that because we are recording proceedings, it really is important that you do speak into a microphone. And so if you do have a question, just raise your hand and Dave Tim will come over and give you a microphone. Without further ado, I'll hand the microphone over to you, Wendy.
Thanks very much, Robin. Can everyone hear me? Can everyone up the back hear me okay? First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet and acknowledge their elders past and present, including any elders that might be present today. Thanks to Robin and to DARU for having me along. It's a great concept for a session, I think, and we're very pleased to be involved in the first lot. I've called my talk Building Partnerships, Working Together to Achieve Human Rights and Equality. Some of you I do know and some of you I don't know. Robin introduced me before. I sit in the Research and Policy section of the Human Rights Commission. My role is largely on disability policy. I also do secretariat for our disability reference group, which I'll talk about a bit later. It's a bit of a tough gig straight after lunch when everyone just wants to have a biscuit and a snooze, but hopefully I'll keep you awake for the session. Like I said, I'm happy to take any questions as we go, just as long as they're not too curly. Advocacy organisations play an important role in improving the lives of people with disabilities. And in bringing public attention to issues affecting people with disabilities. The focus of my presentation today will be on how the Commission works and how our engagement with disability advocates affects the work we do and also, most importantly, the successes we see through our work. You're more than familiar with your work and the importance of it. I'd like to focus on the importance of your work to us and highlight some of the positive work we've done together over the last couple of years, and then I'm going to focus on some key projects that we have underway at the moment, mostly because they're in my area, so I obviously think they're the most important part of the Commission's work, but also because they're key, very important pieces of work that I'd like to have a bit more involvement from the sector with. Yeah. So this is a slide that outlines the program outline for today. So many of people will have participated in Commission training recently with Kenton Miller that was delivered in partnership with DARU. For that reason, I won't focus really heavily on the Equal Opportunity Act or the Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities, except to give you a really broad brush overview of what they look like and how they relate to the work of the Commission. I will talk about how to seek further information and where to seek it for people who are less familiar. So there are opportunities going forward to engage more in learning about that aspect of our work. Today I'm going to focus on how the Commission is structured. So when I first started at the Commission, the most helpful thing for me in terms of demystifying the work was walking from unit to unit, having people introduce the work they did and how external people engage with that work. So I'm going to try and do that in talking form. The aim of that is to talk about how advocacy affects, supports and improves our work and the various ways that advocates can and do work with the Commission on specific projects, but also on advocacy more generally. So I guess when I think about the Commission, I think about it as... sounds like I'm going to start sounding like a tradie towards the end of this presentation because I keep referring to tools and toolkits, but essentially, the way I want to present the Commission today is as a toolkit. So we have several tools that we can use to achieve equality and human rights in the community. Anyone got any questions yet? Apart from how not to break the IT equipment? All right, so in Victoria, there are laws to protect rights by making discrimination, sexual harassment and religious vilification against the law, as well as protecting basic human rights. So the laws that the Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission work with are the Equal Opportunity Act, the Racial and Religious Tolerance Act, and the Victorian Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities. And like I said, I'll give you a really broad brush overview of what they are now. So these laws exist within the Victorian jurisdiction, so they relate to state laws and state government departments. But there are also key pieces of legislation and frameworks at the federal and international level, which many of you will be familiar with as well. That's things like at the federal level, the Disability Discrimination Act, which is key amongst them all, and also the federal standards for things like public transport accessibility. Those things are really carried by the Australian Human Rights Commission, and we're the Victorian Commission that has oversight of the Equal Opportunity Act and the Human Rights Charter. At the international level, there's the UN Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities, which sets out Australia's obligations to protect the rights and dignities of people with disability. So Australia is a signatory, and because we're a signatory, we're required to promote, protect and ensure the full enjoyment of human rights by people with disabilities and ensure they achieve full equality under the law. Some of you will be familiar, but the UNCRPD committees just responded to Australia's report on our obligations under the convention. It's quite an interesting read. There's some interesting work being done around disability that we'll talk about a bit later as well, and justice. Any questions? I'm going to ask you at the end of every slide, I think. So first of all, the Equal Opportunity Act. Can I get a sense of how many people are aware of the Equal Opportunity Act in the room, just to start with? All right, so I'll go quite quickly through it. The objects of the EO Act are clearly stated to include progressive realisation of equality and to eliminate systemic discrimination. So it aims to eliminate discrimination, sexual harassment and victimisation, encourage the identification and elimination of systemic causes of inequality, promote and protect the right to equality in the Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities, and facilitate the progressive realisation of equality as far as reasonably practicable. That just means essentially that we have obligations to respond to discrimination when it occurs, but also in Victoria we have a positive duty to ensure that discrimination does not occur in the first place, which is what people talk about when they talk about the positive duty. So the EO Act protects people from discrimination and harassment in areas of public life such as workplaces, schools, clubs, shops or places that provide services. Discrimination is treating or proposing to treat someone unfavourably because of a personal characteristic which is protected by law. So this includes bullying someone because of a protected characteristic or attribute. So there's 18 protected attributes under the Act. The ones that are probably most pertinent today are number 1, which is disability, number 7, which is carer status, but also number 14, which is personal association, which is something I'll talk a bit more about later. Anyone who's been involved with our complaints process might have some familiarity with how that works. So these are the areas of public life that are protected under the Equal Opportunity Act. So it protects people from discrimination and harassment in areas of public life, and these are the public life areas. So employment, in goods and services, in education, in local government, accommodation, sports, club and club membership, and also disposal of land.
When you're applying for an exemption, do you actually have to apply to you for that exemption, as in the case that you just referred to, or if an employer, and I go back to schools, if they particularly want male teachers over female teachers because they want to increase their number of male teachers, do they actually have to apply to you for that exemption first, or can they just do it? Do you know what I'm saying?
I don't like giving advice like this because I always get it wrong.
Oh, sorry.
But there are exceptions and exemptions. Usually if you're specifying a particular exemption under the Act, you would apply to the Commission. But there are exceptions as well, but I couldn't explain them to you now. I'm so sorry. Yeah. but largely where you're wanting to discriminate for a positive reason, you would seek an exception or an exemption. Yeah. So direct discrimination happens when someone's treated unfavourably because of a personal characteristic, which is what we talked about before. So that might be because of disability or carer status or because you have a personal association with someone who's discriminated against. This happens because people make unfair assumptions about what people with certain personal characteristics can and can't do. So, for example, someone might apply for a position with a construction company, but they don't get the job, and when they call the HR department at the construction company to ask why they weren't chosen, they say, "We've employed people from your country before. You lot don't share our work ethic." So that's an example of direct discrimination. Indirect discrimination occurs when an unreasonable requirement, condition or practice is imposed that disadvantages a personal group because of a personal characteristic. Discriminatory behaviours and actions that affect a personal group with certain characteristics can become entrenched in an organisation or community. If an organisation has a lot of complaints about the same or similar issues, it might be because of entrenched discrimination, which is systemic discrimination. So in the EEO Act, we also have a positive duty. We're the only jurisdiction with a positive duty, and that requires that you must provide reasonable and proportionate measures to eliminate discrimination, sexual harassment and victimisation as far as possible. So essentially what that means is that you have to stop it before it occurs. You have an obligation to make sure there's systems and programs in your place of work or in your organisation to ensure that there is no discrimination in the first place. This is one of those things where Victorians always think they're the best, but in this case we really are. And I'm not from Victoria, so I've taken that on as well. Sorry, I haven't changed my slides. Another way in which we're very lucky to be in Victoria is that we also have a Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities. So this makes sure that the government is conscious of and compliant with human rights in all their decision-making and administration and in all their lawmaking as well. So it sets out basic rights and freedoms and also basic responsibilities of all people in Victoria. It's really about the relationship between government and citizens. So it requires public authorities, such as Victorian State and also local government, departments and agencies, and people who deliver services on behalf of government to act consistently with the Charter. This means that the law must recognise that all people have legal rights and are entitled to equal protection of the law without discrimination. So the grounds for discrimination under the Charter are the same as the Equal Opportunity Act, more or less. So it's things like age, impairment, political belief or activity, race, religious belief, sex or sexual orientation. So there's 20 fundamental human rights that are protected in the Charter. And that includes to be safe from violence and abuse, to be part of a family and to have our privacy respected. So there's some... I mean, there's a lot more too. And if anyone's interested in doing that, we offer training as well, which I'll talk about a bit later on. Does anyone have any questions about that? No? So lots of people are familiar, I think, with how the Equal Opportunity Act works, but I think fewer people are familiar with the application of the Charter and how the Charter is actually an effective tool. So every time the government has to make a law, they have to make sure that it's compatible with the Charter. And often that's a case of them seeking advice from the Commission to ensure there's a compatibility statement, so to make sure those 20 rights under the Act are compatible with any piece of legislation. This is an example of a particular case where the Charter has been really effective. So the Charter doesn't create a new right to begin legal action for a breach of human rights. Instead, its goal is to get things right at the planning and policy stage. It does allow a person to raise human rights argument with existing legal proceedings. So if you're seeking redress for a discrimination case, you might also raise a Charter complaint as part of that process to affect broader policy and program change. So this case example is about a 13-year-old boy with Asperger's syndrome who was ineligible to receive disability support services because autism spectrum disorders weren't considered to be a disability by the relevant department. This case is actually in VCAT at the moment. We won't identify the person in the case, obviously. So the boy's mother applied to VCAT for... This one isn't currently in VCAT. Another one we'll talk about is in VCAT. So the boy's mother applied to VCAT for a review of the decision, advocating for an inclusive interpretation of disability. in the light of rights contained in the Charter. Before the application reached VCAT, the Victorian Government advised that it would acknowledge autism spectrum disorders as a disability and committed to an additional $2.75 million in funding. So that's where the Charter has had a direct effect on state government policy and investment. Does anyone have any questions about that? Yeah?
The relevant charter sections, can you just explain, particularly the second one, right to privacy, that's obviously related to that case.
It's very curly and I don't have it in front of me again.
Oh, you don't have that. Sorry, I'm asking too curly.
No, that's all right. I think it's a fairly straightforward... in this particular case. It might have been an aspect of the case. So it might have been access to records, or it might have been provision of evidence or something like that. I wouldn't be able to tell you because I'm not familiar with the case particularly, but it's around those kinds of issues usually. I'm not a lawyer. Did you want to raise another issue? Okay. I'll just do a quick spruik for our inquiries line at the Commission too, if anyone has any inquiries they'd like to. Hang on, sorry, we're just going to wait for the microphone.
Sometimes I just like to know how you relate things back to the Charter, because when I'm advocating for my child... Mm-hmm. It helps me in knowing how I can take bits of the Charter. And, yes, I have rung your number numerous times, so I'm very familiar with your number.
Good.
But, you know, sometimes knowing that is how to formulate your argument when you actually want to argue for advocating, that's all. And I'm just quite curious on that case.
Yeah.
It's all right. Sorry you don't know the question.
No,
I won't ask
okay.
any more questions.
One of the things I was going to talk about later but I can talk about now is that our legal unit put together a legal resource it's just called a legal resource, really. But what it does is break down the EO Act and the Charter and includes a bit of case law. So you can often refer to that too when you're looking for how things apply to particular cases as well. Yeah, so it's a new legal resource. Yeah. We have a lot on our website. Oh, sorry. I forgot about the microphone again. All right, so this is what I was talking about earlier in terms of walking people through the Commission. If asked what the Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission does, most people would say, first of all, that we take complaints, and second of all, that we provide training. People are often usually familiar with our Commissioner too, which at the moment is Kate Jenkins. She's just recently started with us. And we'll be aware of the Commissioner making public statements about particular issues in the media. We do training and we do complaints, and they're a very important aspect of our work, but we also have other arms and other tools in our toolkit that we use in our work. So all the Commission's project work, all our research, all our information and campaigns are informed by stakeholder groups and by community input. In turn, our work is then used on the ground by advocates, by community organisations and individuals to defend their rights and those of vulnerable people. So on the top of the slide there, you'll see our logo, which is a droplet falling into water. And the idea of that droplet is that the work we do with duty holders, which is people like state government departments, with rights holders, who are the people I talked about earlier as part of protected attributes, and then the broader community, our work filters out through the work of advocacy agencies as well to have a positive impact on community conversations, if that makes sense. So I just want to talk you through each area. I'll do it very quickly, but we have a dedicated media and communications area, and that's headed up by a woman called Ella McPherson, who some of you might be familiar with. So they deliver and develop information resources through a range of targeted publications, community events and online information. So if you look at our website or if you're signed up to our e-bulletin, you'll regularly be made aware of what the Commission's doing publicly, what forums we're holding, what research we're doing, what surveys we've got out, and the work we're doing in partnership with other organisations as well. So it's a good way to keep an eye on how you can get involved in the kinds of issues that you're interested in or that you're advocating around. So this is an example of one media campaign. Oh, you know this one? Yeah. It is good. It was all over the trams for a while. Oh, you've got a can. Yeah. I was going to bring some magnets and I didn't. Anyway, we know we have to be very creative when we're using our communications to ensure that we've most effectively spread the message of equality. So our statutory role in promoting human rights and equal opportunities led to the creation of this anti-hate campaign. So the campaign was delivered in response to complaints received at the Commission about racism in the community, and many of you will be familiar with some of those instances that are in the media about people being harassed on public transport particularly. And it was also based on input from our Reporting Racism Reference Group, which had representatives from key organisations and also stakeholders that were interested in the issue. So the campaign's expanded to include a reporting function and also tips to encourage bystanders to stand up against racism when they see it. So the success of this campaign, it has been a very successful campaign and has extended, is because stakeholders were engaged in its development. So people came to the Commission with issues and we were able to work with them to put together this tool that has actually been really useful and very practical tool. It's a message that resonates with the community for that reason, because the community were the people that put it together in the first place. So essentially, the community and stakeholders were able to use the Commission in that sense as a tool to progress that work, and that is key core work for the Commission as well. So I just think that's a good positive example of how those relationships and how advocacy and the Commission, advocacy agencies and the Commission work together on really practical projects. So I said before that the Commission also, the comms team also do our website and our e-bulletins. And if you're not already signed up to our e-bulletins, I would strongly suggest that you sign up to them. You can do that through the website or via email, or you can also call up the Commission. It's available in alternative formats as well on request. So many of you will be familiar with our training function. It's one of the most identifiable aspects of the Commission's work, I think. So we provide training to community organisations, government agencies and employers. So in those sessions we discuss real-life scenarios to help people understand how the Act works and how the Charter works. Last year we had about 530 sessions, I think, to over about 8,000 participants. So that's a really important part of our work, getting the message around EO responsibilities and human rights out to the community and, most importantly, to workplaces. So some of the work that we did over the last 12 months, and some of the best work I think we did, was in partnership with DARU on the human rights approach to disability advocacy. From our end, that was incredibly worthwhile training, and I think there's some people that we here today that were at that session. I think from what Robin was saying, there's going to be more of it. Yeah, next year, it's fair to say. So keep an eye out for it. We also do training on the Equal Opportunity Act, and we do training on the Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities, but we also do specific sessions on equal opportunity and human rights and disability. And I've got on the slide the date of the next one of those. So that's on the 12th of November from 9:30 till 12:30 on Lygon Street in Carlton, where our offices are. But you can access a full program of our training on the website. Now to complaints. So our complaints function is probably our most visible function. There are very few people, I think, that know about the Commission that don't know that we take complaints. The aim of the complaints function is to ensure compliance under the Equal Opportunity Act, and it's really, I think it's a really valuable tool. In 2012, the Commission received about 11,000 inquiries from about 8,500 people. Disability was the largest attribute of inquiry, and that was followed by race, sexual harassment, age, carer status and sex. So areas of focus for those complaints included education, accommodation and access to premises as well. So I'm sure, I mean, those are probably no surprise to people. So like I said, I'm really just giving a broad brush overview. There is a lot more detail and a lot more information. It's really easy to access that detail and information from the Commission. So if anyone's got any questions or wants to follow up afterwards with me, just come and ask and I'll send you to the right person. So the complaints process is designed to facilitate resolution of disputes under the Act and to do so through conciliation. So we have conciliators in the Commission that do dispute resolution, essentially, and do conciliation between parties to a complaint. It's timely, efficient, flexible and fair and it's provided in a manner which is appropriate to the nature of the dispute. So the way the conciliators are trained is to ensure that there's a quality of representation in conciliation. So parties are given the opportunity to explore resolution of an issue raised in the complaint, which is not a court hearing, so it means not having to go to VCAT, for example. And the parties decide on the terms upon which they agree to resolve a complaint and no outcome can be imposed. So you have to mutually consent to an outcome, essentially. Like I said, I have to say this at the end of most slides, I'm not a lawyer and I can't offer legal advice, and it's very possible I have some detail wrong, so I would encourage people to follow up if they want to pursue particular complaints. It is important to note that you can always contact our inquiries line to find out more, and that isn't necessarily a complaint, and it's totally confidential, and it's also free. So many of you are aware of the complaints process. Many of you have been through the complaints process. I'm keen for those that haven't been involved in the complaints process, they understand why you might make a complaint, get a sense of some of the outcomes of complaints, and then I'll talk a bit about representative complaints, so where someone else might make a complaint on behalf of somebody else. So I've got two case studies that I'll just run through really quickly to give people a sense of the kinds of things that come through to complaints and the kind of outcomes we get through conciliation. So in one instance, a complainant used an electric wheelchair, and on a number of occasions he attended a cinema complex to find that the lift, which he had to use to access the cinema, had been broken. This meant that he was unable to access the cinema. On one occasion he did get into the cinema and was able to watch a movie, but at the completion of the movie he found the lift had broken and he couldn't get off the floor for 2 hours. The lift had been broken on at least 8 separate occasions that year. So when contacted by the Commission, the respondent, who I suppose in this instance would have been the owner of the cinema complex, agreed that the lift had broken down on a number of occasions and agreed to attend conciliation to resolve the complaint. So the complaint was settled following discussions between the parties during the conciliation conference. The respondent or the cinema owner informed the complainant that it was contracting a new maintenance company to service the lifts to ensure they were fully operational and regularly serviced, and agreed to provide training to all staff in handling concerns raised by patrons and reporting these matters to management in the first instance. So you'll see from that complaint, obviously, there was also poor customer service as well as lack of access. In the second case study, the complainant was employed by a manufacturing company. So she walks with a limp due to an accident and having hip replacement surgery as well. So she alleges that a work colleague made fun of her disability by imitating her limp and encouraging others to join in. This work colleague also refused to assist the complainant to retrieve items from a low cupboard as she was experiencing difficulty bending and crouching due to her disability. On another occasion, she was pushed by this work colleague and nearly fell over as she has difficulty balancing. When the respondent was notified about the complaint, they agreed to attend the conciliation conference as well. So while the respondent denied that the discrimination had occurred during discussion at the conciliation conference, it conceded that the work colleague might have engaged in bullying behaviour towards the complainant, not connected to the complainant's disability, so did accept that there had been bullying in that circumstance. So that complaint was settled without an admission of liability for an apology for a revision of the company's grievance policy and $8,800 in compensation. So like I said before, anyone would think that I'm a bit of a tradie with all my talk of tools, unless you took one look at me, but anyway. But my point in all this is not to put forward a paid ad for the Commission's complaint service, but it's really to give you a sense of how the different aspects of the Commission can be used as really powerful tools of advocacy for individuals, but also for the broader community. So if you think you've been discriminated against, sexually harassed, victimised or vilified, you can contact us. And if we can't help you, we try and refer you to somebody who can. So I'll just repeat some key information about the complaints process, which is that it doesn't cost anything to make a complaint with the Victorian Commission, and you also don't need a lawyer to make a complaint. So the Commission will try and help you resolve the complaint. Now, threshold for pursuing conciliation is an alleged convention of the EO Act, so it makes it very accessible in that sense. All you have to do is allege that you were discriminated or treated unlawfully or unfavourably under the EO Act to pursue that conciliation. So this is the bit I was talking about earlier in terms of representative complaints. So for people who recently undertook the training with Kenton, you'll be aware of this, but essentially representative complaints mean that if you work in a community agency that represent or works with someone who has a protected attribute, that's the basis of the complaint, and then the complainant gives you consent, you can actually represent, you can make the complaint on their behalf. So, for example, a parent of an autistic child doesn't have time due to their carer responsibilities, can then give permission to a disability advocate to represent them in a complaint to the Commission. But earlier when I was talking about protected attributes, I talked about disability, I talked about carer status, but I also talked about personal association. So it's worth noting that where you make a complaint, where you can also make a complaint about having a personal association with someone who's been directly discriminated against. So, for example, that might be if you're the parent of a child who's been discriminated against. So, for example, like we talked about before, you weren't able to access the cinema because your child wasn't able to access the cinema. Or in this example of education, I guess, you might be able to make a complaint based on personal association where you haven't been given the benefit of consultation. So you can think about it quite broadly in that sense. It might be that you have a couple of complaints on foot at the same time. So you might have, your child might have a complaint, you might have a complaint, and you might also have a complaint of personal association. So like I said before, it is a really powerful tool and often has really good individual outcomes, but can often affect policy and practice change as well. So now to another part of the Commission. We've been through through complaints and we've been through training. We also have a really big legal unit who undertake a range of legal research, legal and policy advice, interventions, public legal education seminars, and they also produce resources, which I talked about a bit earlier. I won't go into too much detail about our intervention function, except that the role is to advocate the purposes and objectives of the Equal Opportunity Act, to be of assistance to the court and tribunal, to make sure that decision-making aligns with the Charter and also the EO Act. So you can access a full list of our submissions and interventions on our website if you're interested in that. So we exercise the intervention function strategically, and we're involved in a small number of key cases. So interventions usually focus on questions of law, policy and issues of broad public interest rather than arguments about the facts of a case. In this way, the Commission helps to contribute practical downstream effects such as changes to government policy or understanding how the Charter works. So some people who work for disability organisations that might have been involved in legal interventions of one type or another might have been involved in cases where people from the legal unit and the Commission also were providing advice around compliance with the Charter or the EO Act. Did I see a hand? No? Okay. Is this pace all right for everybody? Skipped over about 10 slides, I think. This is not foolproof. All right, so like I said, the legal unit also undertakes legal research and law reform. So we recently made some submissions that you might have seen on our website on things like the Victoria Police Community Consultation on field contact reports and on cross-cultural training, and also put in a submission around the Crime Mental Impairment Act and a submission into the inquiry into the value of a justice reinvestment approach. So we usually consult when we're making those submissions. You can find out about when we're doing our consultations and when we're making our submissions by looking at the website, and you can contact us if you're keen to have some input at that stage. We also can have a disability reference group, which is our formal advisory structure to the Commission, but I'll talk a bit about that later too. Really, that's just about letting you know that that information is there. So if people want to engage, we usually go out to stakeholders to let them know what's happening, when, and also how to participate. The other thing I was going to raise here was the development of legal resources. So the Victorian Discrimination Law Resource is what I was talking about earlier, and it's on our website as well. And it's available in a range of formats. But what you can do is look at that, see key points of law, and also find key cases that apply to that piece of law to give you a sense of the kinds of decisions that are made around key aspects of the Act. This is the best bit. This is so I want to give you an oversight of the Research and Policy Unit. That's my unit. So we actually have a research function under the Equal Opportunity Act, and we have responsibilities under the Charter too. So the Strategic Projects and Policy Unit, which is otherwise known as SPEW, is headed up by Michelle Burrell, and we provide policy advice and direction within the Commission, and we manage key strategic projects around systemic discrimination and human rights issues. So this might be less visible than, say, our training or complaints function, but it's a powerful tool for the Commission and for the community and organisations and advocates we work with. I'm going to run you through some of the key projects that we're halfway through and also one that we're started quite recently, which some of you have been involved in to date. So we use our research function to collaborate with people and organisations to identify and remedy systemic discrimination and breaches of human rights. So to ensure our work's meaningful, relevant and practical, we involve a broad range of community members and stakeholders to ensure that it contributes to improved human rights outcomes for the broader community. So I'll just give you a brief overview of some of our key pieces of ongoing work. We produce guidelines under the Equal Opportunity Act. So we've produced three of those so far. One of them was on sexual harassment and employers' responsibilities. One of them was on transgender people in employment. One of them was on recruitment, so a guide for recruitment agencies about not discriminating against people in employment and recruitment practices. And we've got some coming up, one for general practices and also one for people with mental health disability in the workplace. We also make submissions like the legal unit do. So quite recently we made a submission to the Review of Disability Standards for Accessible Public Transport. And the way we did that is quite a good example, I think, of the way the Commission engages with advocates and community organisations to get to represent, I guess, community attitudes towards particular issues. So in that case, we're quite lucky because VCOS had done quite a bit of work and quite a bit of consultation in the lead-up that they were willing to share with us, which was great. We also had an online survey, which we put up in the hope that some people would respond, and in the end, about 160 people did, which was fantastic. And we made the submission to DSAPT based on those findings. So you can see our submission on our website. But what we've done as well is put together a report based on the survey outcomes, and that should be launched, I think, in the next week or so. So what that'll have in it is some of the key pieces of legislation and standards, a bit of a sense of where things are up to in terms of compliance, responses to the survey to give people a... I guess the idea of it is to give people a tool to use when they're advocating in this space. So something you can go and shake at people and say, these are the findings, this is the evidence we have to suggest that this is not working or this is a gap in public transport accessibility. No pun intended. We also do... a lot of stakeholder engagement. So we're involved on a lot of different forums and project groups, and we're always interested in work that's being done in the community and in organisations and how we can participate and be useful. So we do encourage people to come to us with any work, and I personally would encourage people to come to me, and I've got cards if there's any particular projects in the field that we could assist with or be involved in some way. And I'm saying that because I'm going to ask the same of everybody in the rooms shortly. So what I want to do is run through three of our major projects. Some of you will know them well and some of you might be less familiar with them, so I'll give you quite a comprehensive look. Is anyone familiar with this report? This is called Held Back, the Experiences of Students with Disabilities in Victorian Schools. So this was a major report that we did last year. We did this report following concerns raised by our disability reference group by parents, advocates and students about discrimination in the provision of education services to students with disabilities. So we undertook this research. So I guess, I mean, this shows another reason that the complaints function is really useful too. I mean, it's a confidential process, but it doesn't mean we can't draw out key learnings about what the key issues for the Victorian community are through that process. And that was certainly one of the key drivers for this work, apart from the very vocal advocates, very vocal students, and also parents of people with disability, children with disabilities in schools. So the purpose of this project was to learn how schools are meeting students' needs and, more importantly, where practice might be improved. So we spoke to more than 1,800 students, parents and educators in the research through an online survey, a phone-in and a have-a-say day. So there was, I think, a few have-a-say days across Victoria. And 1,800 people is a lot. We're a small team, but it just showed the level of interest and engagement in that project, I think, and the need there was for some evidence base for people to be able to do the advocacy well in that space. So Helbeck found that half of students and parents surveyed reported discrimination at school, and one in four educators had witnessed discrimination, which is huge. One in five parents who said discrimination had occurred did not complain because they were fearful of repercussions for themselves or their child, and another third said they didn't think complaining would make a difference. Four out of ten educators said they were not aware of their legal obligations to students with disabilities under the Disability Standards for Education. And 6 out of 10 students, 60%, said they'd been bullied because of their disability. So the Helbeck report made 50 recommendations, and the Commission continues to work with education authorities to support the implementation. So we just had a 12-month update on the project, which you can find on our website as well, and which I won't go through in any detail, but it outlines things like that DECD have established a cross-department senior officers group to consider the recommendations, to review existing programs and use the information in the report to identify opportunities and implement actions to strengthen guidelines and practice, amongst other changes. But it's an example of where you got enough people shouting, essentially. Yeah, it was a good piece of work. So this is an example of how the community and organisations work with Commission to do problem-solving advocacy in a way that's really positive and also quite effective. Is anyone familiar with this report? This one's called Desperate Measures. It's about issues faced by families relinquishing children with disability into state care. So although I'm referring to these reports as reports, they're essentially, I'm saying essentially a lot, they're projects, and the report is really only over the halfway point of the work that we do. So we work really in three stages. First, we work with community through consultation to identify the needs or the gaps in the systems and to clarify the purpose of a piece of work that we do or a piece of research. So secondly is where we consult and we build the evidence base and we report, and that's a process of working with community and with organisations and agencies to find out what's going on and then to find out what would work to improve practice. And then the second half of our projects are really focused on implementation, so how we make sure that the recommendations are taken up. And that's never just our job. That's always the job of the agencies the recommendations refer to, but it's also advocates. It always comes back to really strong advocates in any sense, I think, as well. So this report's based on Commission research of the issues faced by families relinquishing children with disability into state care. So the research found that 50 or more families surrender the day-to-day care of their child with disability to the state each year because they cannot get access to the support they need to continue caring full-time. So it looked at the nature, extent and causes of relinquishment of children under 18. So the reason we did this project differs a bit from the work we did on the Helbeck report in that the main focus of this work was to expose the problem. So everybody knew there was a problem, but the extent of the problem was still a bit mysterious and in the shadows. So the focus was really to create the evidence base, another tool, to assist advocates in their work on this issue and to give us some leverage to do further work on this issue as well. So this is a really good example of where advocates engage the Commission to identify and develop a piece of work and to assist in, excuse the terminology, but to assist in arming advocates in the community around this issue. So for those of you that are unfamiliar with the report and interested in the report, I do have a couple of copies of it, but we also have it available on the website and in alternative formats for people who might like to get it. So we're continuing to take every opportunity to pursue the recommendations here, and we really welcome and have welcomed its take-up by advocates more broadly as well. I think we're starting to see some change, which is very positive. So this gets to my project, which I think is a very interesting project, and I'm sure based on your discussions this morning, people might have some questions or input that they'd like to record as we go on. So this is another major project. So this is in keeping with desperate measures and held back. Just showing some copies of them to give you a sense of what they look like in their final form. So this project is looking at the experiences of people with disability reporting crime to police. So the reason we're doing this project is because our disability reference group raised it as a key issue, and also there's a few bits of complementary work going on as well, including the parliamentary inquiry into access to justice for people... Sorry, access to and interaction with the justice system for people with intellectual disability and their carers. It's also in response to key cases you'll be aware of, some of which were in the media, and I'm sure that John Chesterman referred to earlier. The Urella case is obviously one that comes to mind fairly easily. The aim of the project is to focus on the experiences of victims of crime, so particularly victims of crime experiencing crime against the person. So we're not looking at things like fraud or theft, we're looking at crime against the person. The reason we're focusing on victims reporting crime is because there is a real absence of evidence around the experiences of victims particularly, and particularly as they're accessing police services. So some of the things we're looking at as part of the project are why things are considered crimes in some settings and not in other settings. So some examples of that might be in disability services, in hospitals, and also in schools. And I'm sure there are people here who are familiar with that issue. We're also looking at the reasons people do report crime, and very much, and as the data collection period goes on, the reasons people don't report crime. So trying to uncover the reasons that, or the barriers that exist for people reporting. And we're looking at the barriers for people with disability reporting. We're looking at the reason service providers might not report, and we're looking at reasons why family members might not report as well. We do have a few focus group sessions coming up, which are on the Daru website, and I forgot to actually bring the dates, but they're in the next couple of weeks. We've got 5 sessions altogether. So we have 2 for self-advocates, one which is a women's only session, and we also have 2 for people with mental health disability. One of those is a mental health disability session, a women-only session as well. And we have one for people, a dedicated one for people with ABI that we're partnering with an organisation to deliver. I can send out the information on those to anyone who might like to participate. As part of that project, we're doing a range of data collection methods. So we've got a survey on our website that people can fill in. There's a question, is there? I'll stop.
Thank you. Carol O'Kine, Barwon Disability Resource Council. I was just wondering if any of those sessions are out of the Melbourne area.
No, we haven't dedicated any sessions to out of the Melbourne area, but we're also doing focus groups with organisations, and we're doing one-on-one case study interviews with people who'd like to participate, and we've been travelling a lot to regional areas for those case study interviews. We're not limited to the Melbourne Metro region by any stretch. So there's plenty of flexibility for us to come out to people who are interested in participating. So like I said, there is the online survey. We're also doing case study interviews with people who want to tell their own experience. We're also doing a series of key informant interviews with experts or key organisations that are involved in issues around reporting crime. And we're also doing data collection through key agencies. So we're getting... we're doing interviews and focus groups with police too. I believe I forgot to say that. But we're also getting data from police and from DHS and from the Disability Services Commissioner and OPA to assist us in getting a broad picture of why people do and don't report, and also when they do report to police, are they treated fairly by police? So I'd be looking to people here, first of all, if anyone's got any comments that would be interesting to hear, but also if anyone thinks that they can help promote the project or if they'd like to be involved in the project in any way, to speak to me after the session. Does anyone have any questions at all? Any comments?
Hi, this is Karen Taranto from Vision Australia. I have two questions and they're unrelated to each other. So the first one is, other than drawing evidence from complaints that the Commission receives, how do you identify what your policy and research priorities are?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll respond to that one first. So we have a series of ways that we engage with the community. The complaints process is certainly one of those, and we do draw out key trends, I suppose, in complaints to guide some of our work, but we also consult broadly with the community. And in terms of our disability-related projects, we have a formal advisory structure to the Commission, which is the Disability Reference Group, which I'll talk about shortly. That's provided the impetus for these major projects. We're also quite strategic in how we choose our projects based on what else is happening in the space, what other work people are doing, and engagement with key partners and agencies as well. And some of it is just that environmental scanning, what's going on, what are the issues coming out in the media, what are the things that people are raising with us, you know, when we're out and about as well. So.
And the other question was about making recommendations in the reports that you publish. So I understand that, I guess I want to know what organisations, how are recommendations adopted by organisations? How do you promote adopting the recommendations that you make?
Okay, so like I said, the report is only over the halfway point of the project. There's a whole bunch of consultation, relationship management, consultation really, that leads up to the report and leads up to the development of the recommendations as well. So on all our major projects, we have a project reference group that provides key input. So, for example, on this police and disability project, we have organisations like Victoria Police, Disability Services Commissioner and the Office of Public Advocate. We also have organisations like FALAD or Disability Justice Advocacy or Victorian Women with Disabilities. So we try and get a broad range of people on our project reference groups, but we also try and get the key players to the table as we develop the project, because that's really the only way you get engagement and buy-in, I think, and especially when your focus is on practical outcomes and actually ensuring that the project and the recommendations are picked up, you need to be doing that engagement early on, which I know Vision Australia does quite well. Thanks. Has anyone else got any questions at all about this project? Okay. I've been saying it for a while, but I did want to talk about a key way that we work with advocates particularly in directing what we do. So the Disability Reference Group was established so that we could hear directly from people with disability about systemic discrimination and human rights issues that impact upon people with disability. Am I going all right for time? 3 minutes. Talk really fast. The group includes members who have direct experience of disability, parents of children with disability, services providers and advocates. And I had hoped the chair would be here to help me co-present today, but he's off to Singapore having a lovely time, so good luck to him. So the DRG is a really highly engaged committee, and we rely on they're significantly important to the Commission, so we do rely quite heavily on them in terms of raising systemic issues and also in terms of building informal and also formal networks for the work that we do. As well as identifying key areas of research and policy work, the group's influenced our submissions, so the submissions made by the Commission, and supported a great deal of our other work too, so lots of our public transport accessibility work, for example. One of our DRG members is here. I don't know if he wants me to point him out, but nice to see you. They're everywhere. There's always a DRG member at things. It's good. So the Commission and DRG have been able to work closely on a number of key pieces of work. So the three ones that I've talked about so far really are key examples of that. So the Disability Reference Group meets four times a year, and members are appointed for a two-year period. The reason I'm talking about this is because the next recruitment round for the Disability Reference Group will happen in 2014. So in autumn 2014 will be a new round. We'll put out notices for expressions of interest, particularly through our e-bulletin, but also through our networks. And that will explain the process for nomination. There's usually 17 members on that reference group. And I'm happy to answer any questions about how it functions or, you know, anything that relates to it generally. I guess the other aspect of the Disability Reference Group that's been really important is that there's a good mentoring structure. So for people who are new to advisory groups like that, or people that are new to disability advocacy in that way. So, for example, for me, over the last 10 months, it's been an incredibly valuable source of information material and just general stakeholder knowledge, really, which has been great. So, like I said, we'll start the recruitment for that probably around April next year. Worth keeping an eye out because it is a very influential and very engaged committee. So I'm just going very fast, sorry, Robin. I just wanted to give you an overview to talk about the ways that we engage with the community and the ways you engage with us. So an overview of the way we engage are through training and equipping people to know about their rights under the EO Act and the Charter, promoting rights talk in the community. So that's some of our media and communication. It's about tooling people up, and it's about having a presence in the community, I think, as well, and making sure that we are linked in with projects and work that's going on with other organisations. Our complaints function, obviously, policy and law reform, our projects and policy, and our formal advisory structure as well. So I hope this has been useful, and thanks for listening to me, giving me some air time. And like I said, I'm more than happy to take any more questions, but given my time's up, we might do that while everyone's having a bit of a stretch, if that's all right. So thanks again, Robin and Daru, for letting us participate today.
Thank you, Wendy.
That concludes session 2, Building Partnerships.